Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Professor Jeremy Black talking about the Crusades and medieval warfare.
Thank you. I've deliberately chosen to start with an image from the period. The image is from the Mappa Mundi, which means map of the world, that's kept in Hereford Cathedral. It's one of the only maps from that period, world maps from that period, known to survive. Obviously, from our point of view, it has lots of flaws. As you will know, the world is not it's surrounded by a little ocean like this. But what it captures is the way in which, in Christian Europe in that period, there was a clear understanding of where the world was and how it was organised. How it was organised was it what was known as a T-O map. There's the O of the world. There's a T. And in the centre of the world is what? Jerusalem, OK? You can't really see it, but on top of the world, drawn in the map, that is Christ sitting in majesty, sending sinners to hell and the saved to heaven. And the point is that what that map creates, what it offers, is a view of the world in which time and space are the same. They're not separate, they're the same. The idea is that human beings have fallen, they've been pushed on earth because of the sin of Adam. They are going to live on earth until the last judgment occurs, when they will be divided for good between the sinners and the saved. And in the meanwhile, on this earth, which, as you can see, if you're interested, that, by the way, is England, that is Ireland, that is the edge. So not very far to go off from Ireland and to fall off the edge. But the point is that in the meanwhile, you have Jerusalem, because that is where, obviously, in the kind of the Christian ideas, Christ had come, and where again he would come in part of the redemption of human species at the end of time. Jerusalem, in short, had a meaning to contemporaries that was not simply one of power in a sense of the world, not simply one of maybe new lands to conquer. It was one of what, which was a sort of existential meaning, a place which would enable human beings to be redeemed from their own sinfulness. Now, to us, this may appear a bit weird, a bit odd, but you have to bear in mind that for most of human history, and to this day, for many individuals, but for most of human history, religious notions of time and space have come to the fore. And that is why the idea that Jerusalem should be, as it were, freed, that was the term they used, that Jerusalem should be freed and become Christian again, was one that had great emotional power in the 11th, the 12th and the 13th centuries. Indeed, it went on having power thereafter. If you're looking, for example, at why Christopher Columbus went west in the 1490s to the New World and why Vasco da Gama went to India, you can produce secular interpretations. They wanted great wealth, all the rest of it. But actually, in part, for both Spain and Portugal, the purpose of gaining wealth, the purpose of becoming more powerful, was to take part in a sort of battle of last time and again to drive the Islam out of Jerusalem. And if you want to think about this in terms of modern popular culture, the clearest and closest example in modern popular culture is the symbolization that you get in J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, where individual places, and in fact individual fortified places, take on symbolism, take on value, because of this idea of time and space having meaning. Well, I'm afraid we have to move from that to a more, as it were, accurate map. But if we move to that more accurate map, where again there's Jerusalem down there, you get a sense of it, as it were, of Jerusalem of off the edge, a sense that in a way it's part of a world which is eccentric to Europe, a long way away. That, remember, is not how contemporaries saw of Europe. The most important European city, in many senses, is a city that is today not part of Christendom. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Constantinople, well done. So Constantinople was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, the direct continuation of the Roman Empire, because obviously Rome itself had fallen in 410 to Goth invaders. The Western Roman Empire had come to an end in 476. But when you're starting off in the 1090s, that is the real centre of Christendom. And of course, it is worth bearing in mind that Christendom, in our eyes, was pushed westwards by the advance of Islam. But in the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, areas such as Egypt, what we would now call Israel, what we would now call Syria, what we would now call Lebanon, what we would now call Iraq, all of those areas were either fully Christianized in the case of Egypt or partly Christianized. And with the advance of Islam, there was no inherent sense among Christians that this was the end as they knew it, that Christianity had been pushed back. Incidentally, again, if you want to look at a modern example of the same kind of values, you can see the way that Islamic fundamentalists today still refer to Al-Andalus as part of what should be Islamic. Well, in fact, towns like Cordoba or Seville were conquered by Christian Spain in the 13th century. Granada, the last one, fell in 1492. But they're still treating it as if it was yesterday, and therefore a yesterday that should be reversed. So the Crusades had meaning to contemporaries in that culture. That's point number one. Point number two, in military and political terms, in the 11th, 12th and 13th centuries, it's the most obvious example of a united European project. Now, by that, I don't mean that all Europeans took part in it. I don't mean that they all took part happily in it. And I don't mean that they didn't at times hit each other over the heads. But it was the European project of its day, rather like the Third Reich was the European project of its day in the early 1940s, or you might have views on the situation since. In other words, political issues that could engender support among a wide amount of the political groupings within Europe can be seen. And that itself is interesting. It was organised in order to take advantage of the combination of roughly, I think one could say fairly, three main developments. Number one development was the extent to which feudal society in Europe, developing in the 10th and 11th century, having overcome in the late 10th and 11th centuries the challenge by, quote, a new lot of, quote, barbarians. They didn't think of themselves as barbarians. The Vikings and the Magyars in Hungary, who were defeated in the 10th century, now had the energy to look to expand. So in part, it's the expansionism of feudal society that is a key element. Number two, it gives a role to the ascendancy that is developing culturally in Western Europe of the papacy. The papacy in the late 11th century, particularly under Pope Gregory the Seventh, had a big row with the emperors, so the investiture crisis. It gives a role, they're newly ascendant, newly energetic. It gives the papacy a role as a kind of organizer of a European project. And lastly, the developing European commercial cities, of which the most important are Venice and Genoa, are looking for economic opportunity in the lands to the east. So there are reasons why you should get it. You should get this sort of energy. The particular provocation was the Seljuk Turks come west in the 1070s, 1080s, and 1090s, do extremely well against Constantinople or Byzantium, and Constantinople sends out, as it were, an appeal for help. That's our narrative of the Crusades, and it's an accurate narrative. But there is also another narrative that's worth bearing in mind. And this other narrative that's worth bearing in mind is the one that one looks at, if you like, when I mention the Seljuk Turks coming west. Because the tendency is to see the Christians as against Islam. In fact, the entire period of the Crusades also saw bitter warfare between Islamic powers in the Near and Middle East. And as it were, the Christians fed into that warfare, sometimes on one side, sometimes on the other. So that if you were thinking, for example, about the 12th century in the Near East, the most important thing is the rise of Saladin, who, as you know, conquered Jerusalem from the Crusaders in 1187. Well, the point is that, yes, he beat up on the Crusaders, but he also beat up on the other local powers. The Seljuk Turks at the beginning were fighting the Fatimids of Egypt. The Crusaders arrive and get fed into that conflict, benefiting from the fact that one side is already weakened by the other side. Or lastly, before we press on, in 1258... probably the most dramatic fall of a major Islamic centre in the Middle East took place. And it wasn't the fall of Jerusalem to Crusaders. It wasn't the Crusaders' attempts to take Cairo, as St. Louis, the French king, Louis the 11th, tried to do in the 13th century. In 1258, the Mongols took Baghdad. They wrapped the last of the Abbasid caliphs, the, as it were, leader of Islam, they wrapped him in a carpet, and then they crushed him within the carpet under horses' hooves, because they believed that it would actually be a bad thing if they actually saw the blood of the last of the caliphs. Didn't stop them killing him, of course. And that triumph for the Mongols, the destruction of Baghdad in 1258, was to be referred to by, of all people, Saddam Hussein in 2003, when he warned about what he called a new barbarism coming. So in other words, bear in mind that when you're thinking about the Christians from Europe fighting people from the Muslims in the Near East, actually the whole situation is much more dynamic, and with it, warfare is more dynamic. There are no, as it were, essential forms of warfare that are unchanging on either side. Now, what can one say about war in the Middle East and more generally in Europe at that period? Well, number one point, the usual way of looking at it, the classic Hollywood way of looking at it, is to emphasize the role of cavalry. And to, with emphasizing the role of cavalry, put the focus on battle between cavalry forces. Well, one would be foolish to ignore that, but what there has been a tendency to do is to underplay the continued and continuing significance of infantry, and to also underplay the continued and continuing significance linked to that of infantry of siegecraft. In many senses, the Crusades were wars of sieges. There are two really famous field battles. There are one or two others, but there are two really famous ones at Hattin and at Arsuf. I'm not denying that there are others, for example, the attempt at the relief of Antioch. But what is the case is that field battles were much less important than sieges. And that's more generally true of medieval warfare as a whole. And there are a whole host of reasons for that. One is that if you're trying to take political control over an area, what you need and wish to do is to seize the centres of power, and power in that period is castellated. The biggest castles are not standalone castles like Crac de Chevalier or Chateau Gaillon in Normandy. The biggest castles are actually the castellated cities. In other words, cities which are completely surrounded by at least one, sometimes two, but at least one ring of walls, these walls themselves being strong enough to reject siege. So, for example, we've already heard mention of Constantinople or Byzantium. Constantinople, under the Theodosian walls built in the 4th century, had a circuit of walls of roughly 11 miles long. This is really impressive. Antioch had a circuit of walls of about 6 miles long. Milan in northern Italy had a circuit of walls of about 6 miles long. All of the major cities in Europe and in the Near East. I've already mentioned Baghdad. Baghdad had to be taken by the Mongols as a city which they had to learn to besiege. Winning a battle in the countryside was not going to help you very much if you wanted to take cities. Most cities had their own water supplies, their own food stores. They could sit out sieges, sometimes sieges of a very long time. So that what one's actually getting in this period is the development of more sophisticated siege processes, and with that, the development to counter it of more successful fortification processes. If you look at the Crusades as a whole, for the First Crusade, the most dramatic sieges were, of course, Antioch and then Jerusalem. And the sieges involved a mixture of things. You could try with walls, you could try and climb over them, you put ladders up against them, or you bring up towers against them, the old Roman system. And quite frankly, this was a system that required thousands of men and masses of man hours. The old Roman process was to build an earthen ramp up against the fortress walls. A ramp which was as high in the end as the walls themselves, and you strengthened it with timber, and then you brought up towers along it, moving towers on rollers, and you then fired down onto the walls. An extraordinary effort involved. In the medieval period, the emphasis instead was to try and smash through a breach at the main gates. It was the main gates that were usually the weakest part of any fortification, because obviously they were moving parts, and that's what you tried to do. So at Baghdad, for example, in 1258, as I've mentioned, the Mongols used trebuchets. Trebuchets, I take it you know what they are. These are these enormous catapults firing large stones, and the force of a counterpoised catapult firing a large stone depends upon the actual size of the stone, and it depends upon the tension built into the system. But it was quite strong enough after a series of them to break through the gates in 1258. Other sort of things you use with catapults, you see it, for example, with the siege by the Mongols of Kafr in the Crimea, is that they put corpses, plague-ridden corpses, and fired them into the Genoese-held fortress there, fortress city there, which indeed is how the Black Death and the plague entered Europe, because the Genoese were actively trading from the Crimea through. Other ways of doing it, you can try undermining. You get that, what was known as mining, in which you dig a hole underneath the other side's walls. You generally then fill it, because this is pre-gunpowder, you generally fill it with firewood and you set fire to it. That was what you generally did. So you could try undermining it by some means or other. These techniques develop quite considerably. They require very large numbers of men, and you need lots of infantry, and cavalry is a complete and utter waste of time in these activities. It's expensive, you have to feed the horses somehow. It's much cheaper and much easier to run an infantry army than a cavalry army. In response to that, of course, defenders build up and take forward their own techniques of protecting positions, so that you get steadily more complex castle or castellated city processes, in which you get multiple walls, you get countermining underneath, which is a very big process. You get the development of what would later be called bastions. I mean, they're not full bastions, but they're designed to try and make it harder to approach the vulnerable positions, particularly near the gates. And one of the obvious ways to do that is the kind of using of round towers near fortified gateways in a sort of bastion-like fashion. The Romans had done that in the 3rd century AD when they were fearing, quote, barbarian attacks. This process gets sort of revived During the medieval period, a lot of the medieval warfare represents a revival of processes known by to the Romans. And again, you can understand that much more if you put the emphasis on infantry, because it's infantry, of course, that the Romans were particularly effective at. What other elements are worth bearing in mind militarily? Well, an obvious one is a simple point. You have to get here. Now, the First Crusade, as you know, goes through Anatolia. That's Anatolia, the Asian part of Turkey. Part of the Third Crusade, the German contingent under Barbarossa, goes overland. But most of the time, the Crusaders sail to the Near East, or to the other places they launch crusades against, Egypt and Tunis. Okay. Now, that itself is in many respects a sign of the greater wealth and sophistication of European society by the 11th, 12th or 13th century compared to where it had been in the 6th, 7th or 8th centuries. The actual ability to produce a large enough number of ships to actually transport people, because of course on top of that you have to have the space in the ships for the crew, is really quite impressive. It's again another reason why cavalry is relatively unimportant. You do have some troop transports in that period that can carry horses. Allegedly there was some used when the Normans invaded England in 1066. But there's a practical problem with moving horses by the sea. These are unstabilized ships, and you've got big risks of horses breaking their legs. So essentially, it's infantry forces that get moved. Major intermediaries, as I've mentioned, to Venice and Genoa, but for example, the English, when they helped the Portuguese recapture Lisbon from the Moors in 1147-48, they've sailed all the way there. English ships. Third Crusade. And you've got this quite high capacity. These are not ships that, as it were, can operate with complete strategic freedom. Shipping of that period was very dependent, of course, on the current. It was very dependent on the wind direction. Essentially, in the Eastern Mediterranean, the prevailing direction of the winds is this way round, which means that there's an enormous advantage for the Crusaders. They go via Cyprus, which Richard the Lionheart captured in the Third Crusade, and then drop down on the coast, particularly to Acre. The major Islamic naval power in the region is Egypt. It is very difficult for ships to sail that way because the prevailing wind direction, as I've said, is in this direction. Ships, when they fought each other, are fundamentally fighting very similarly to how they fight on land. They do carry artillery. Artillery are not obviously gunpowder cannon in their type. The artillery are what Roman-style ballistas, in other words, kind of giant crossbows, which fire iron-tipped wooden stakes. Quite dangerous, very difficult to aim accurately. And if you think about it, if you think of two ships and they're going up and down in the sea, it's very difficult to get it right. If you shoot on a down, you'll go underneath the other ship. If you shoot on an up, the danger is you go straight over it. You might hit any rigging, but the danger is you get straight over it. So usually ships came as close as possible to each other. You would engage and you would try and board the other side, you know, storm its deck as if you were on land. And that technique goes on being important right through Mediterranean warfare, even when cannon come in. So the greatest sea battle of the early modern period, the Battle of Lepanto in 1571 between the Turks and the Christian powers, takes place there on the west coast of Greece. In practical terms, although there are some cannon, in practical terms, it's exactly the same. It is a land conflict fought on the water. Now, What other elements are worth bearing in mind if you want to think about the history of war in this period? Well, first of all, the actual ability to produce the agricultural surplus in order to sort of supply these armies was not easy for societies which had a relatively low agricultural productivity. So what you get, what that means in practice, is you get a fair amount of brutalization of civilians. Civilian society generally has the choice between what they would like to have, which is a system of extortion and protection racket. Somebody comes into your village and says, we're going to burn it down unless you produce, you know, 200 loaves of bread by tomorrow morning and 30 chickens. That's fine. What you don't want is for them to just start burning it down in order to try and find the loaves of bread and the chickens. But in either case, it's pretty unpleasant. And this is exacerbated because in this period, both societies, both Christendom and Islam, were slave societies. In Christendom, the largest slave markets were at Constantinople and at Venice. And of course, as you're probably aware, the European word slave is a variation on the word Slav. A lot of the original slaves were actually taken out of the Balkans. But if you could grab Muslims, you would use them as slave labor. Exactly the same for the Islamic societies. In the Islamic societies, it was regarded as sort of pejorative, unacceptable for men to engage in hard physical work. You got the slaves to do that. And there was also large-scale seizure of women for sex slavery. So you've got slavery as part of the context, astonishing brutalization of the population, which tends to not be something that is much talked about. Very large, if you have a storming of a city, it was quite normal as part of the conventions of war that if a city went on resisting once the wall was breached, in other words, if they didn't surrender at once, it was regarded as perfectly within the rights of war in order to sort of seize, murder, rape, do whatever you like to the population within it. And on top of that, neither Christians nor Moors paid much attention to each other. So, for example, when Jerusalem was seized in the First Crusade, large numbers of the civilian population, whether they were Moors, whether they were Orthodox Christians, or whether they were Jews, were killed or reduced to slavery. When the Moors took Byzantium finally in 1453, again, vast numbers of people were slaughtered, and those who weren't slaughtered were mostly enslaved. So very high rates of brutalization of the population. Last point before I take some questions. Is there much development in warfare in this period? Historians tend to be interested in change, and they often have a sort of technological obsession. In other words, the idea that you produce a new technology, gunpowder, steam engines, atomic bombs, whatever you want, you are going to fundamentally transform war. That actually is a very suspect view. War fundamentally is a matter of imposing your will on other people. The technology may vary, but the political and social problem remains. How do you get somebody else to internalize your values sufficiently to stop resisting you, whether it's an international struggle or whether it's a domestic struggle? There was obviously much harder to do that if you're at the cultural margins. But the interesting thing is, if you look at that map, it actually worked for both sides. Largely, I'm afraid, through what we would call, and it's a very unattractive point to note, ethnic cleansing. In the end of the day, Spain, which had been very much an Islamic society, much of it for 600 years, was Christianized, and first the Muslim inhabitants were thrown out, and then the conversos, those who had nominally converted to Christianity, were thrown out. Conversely, the same thing in Turkey. culminating in 1922, 1923 with the mass slaughter of Greek Christians in the area of the Ionian coast, Izmir, Smyrna in particular. So ultimately, war worked in this period in delivering military verdicts, but in order to entrench those military verdicts, it tended to be accompanied by things that, which quite frankly, we find very unappealing. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.